We had a bad road in front of us and a world of trouble behind. Chapter 35. We sang. Mac and I sang Midnight Special and all the old Delta Blues standards as we barreled south through the deepening night, down roads I had only traveled once before in my life, terrified that I would miss a turn or take the wrong fork and finally cost him his life just as certainly as I had cast it into the balance up on the clifftop. We sang to keep Mac's creeping unconsciousness at bay. We sang to thumb our nose at death, our unseen passenger, and we sang to say that we were alive and we loved life and that nobody in that vehicle was going to be taken easy or without a fight. It started to rain. We had driven south, moving fast into an increasingly remote area with only the scattered lights of small farms to tell us where the land ended and the sea began. At last I saw the turnoff I was looking for, took it in a shower of gravel, and started a long descent towards a secluded fishing village. We came round the tip of a headland, met the rain full on, and saw lights huddled together at the water's edge. I reached the village and found a narrow street which looked familiar. Mac had slipped into a kind of half-world. My jacket was soaked with his blood, and I drove one-handed, constantly trying to keep him awake and fighting. Hoping to hell I hadn't made a mistake in my navigation, I turned a corner and saw a communal water fountain surrounded by dead flowers, and with an old bucket tied to a rope, and knew that I was close. I drew to a stop in the darkness, grabbed my flashlight from my keychain, and shone it on the front gate. I didn't want to have a half-dead man over my shoulder and knock at the wrong door. The beam of the flashlight picked out a brass plaque on the gate. Unpolished and faded, written in English, it gave the occupant's name and the details of his degrees, in medicine and surgery, from Sydney University. In light of the nature of the guy practicing there, it probably wasn't the best advertisement for that august institution. I opened the passenger door, lifted Mac onto my shoulder, kicked open the gate, and headed towards the front door of the rundown cottage. It opened before I got there. The doctor had heard the car stop outside and had come to investigate. He stood on the threshold peering out. A face like an unmade bed, skinny legs in a pair of baggy shorts, and a t-shirt so faded that the stripper bar it advertised had probably closed years ago. He was in his early 40s, but given his love of the bottle, if he made 50, it would be a surprise. I didn't know what his real name was. Thanks to the plaque on the gate, all the Turks in the area knew him simply as Dr. Sidney, and that seemed to suit him fine. I had met him a week earlier when, after control had made the arrangements, I was sent to test the route. He had been told I was a tour guide escorting a group of Americans through the area who might need, in the unlikely event of an emergency, his assistance. I don't think he believed a word of it, but by all accounts, he didn't like the Turkish authorities very much, and our substantial cash advance encouraged him not to ask any questions. "Hello, Mr. Jacobs," he said. Jacobs was the name I was using in Turkey. He looked at Mac draped over my shoulder and saw the blood-soaked jacket tied around his waist. "Quite a tour you must be running there. Remind me not to take it." In my experience, most Australians aren't easily rattled, and I was deeply grateful for that. Together we carried Mac into the kitchen, and though the doctor's breath reeked of booze, there was something in the way he straightened his back and cut away Mac's clothes and damaged tissue that told me he had once been a surgeon of discipline and skill. I used whatever of my medical training I could remember to act as his theater nurse, and with the hot water running, the kitchen bench swept clear to provide a table, the reading lamps from his study and bedroom pressed into service to illuminate the wound, we tried desperately to stabilize the shattered body and keep Mac alive until the chopper with its specialists and bags of plasma arrived. Not once through that harrowing time did the doctor's hand shake or his commitment falter. He extemporized and cursed and dragged out from beneath the layers of booze and wasted years every idea and strategy he had ever learned. It didn't work. Mac faded, and we fought harder. We got him back. Then he faded again. With the chopper barely 18 minutes away, the bluesman seemed to sigh. He lifted one hand up as if to touch our faces in silent thanks, and flew away. We fought even harder, but there was no calling him back that time, and we both fell still and quiet at last. Dr. Sidney hung his head, and it was impossible from where I was standing to see whether his body was trembling from fatigue or something far more human. After a moment, he looked up at me, and I saw in his eyes the despair, the anguish it caused him to have someone die in his hands.
"I used to operate on injured children,"
he said quietly, as if in explanation for the drink, the rundown cottage, the life in exile, and the acres of pain he carried with him. I nodded, finding at least some understanding of what it must have been like to lose a young kid under the knife.
"He was a friend of yours?"
he asked. I nodded, and with a decency that no longer surprised me, he made an excuse and found something to do in another part of the house. I drew the sheet over Mac's face. I wanted him to have all the dignity I could give him, and said a few words. You couldn't call it praying, but out of respect, in the hope that his spirit was somewhere close at hand, I said what I needed to about friendship, courage, and hopeless regret for breaking the rules up on the clifftop. The doctor returned and started to clean up, and I walked out into his living room. It was 14 minutes until the chopper arrived, and a message on my cell phone told me they had identified a garbage dump behind town where they could land without being seen. Keeping the tremor out of my voice, I called and said they could stand the medics down. It wasn't a patient they would be evacuating. It was a body. I got rid of the vehicle by giving it to Dr. Sidney. It was small recompense for the effort he had made to save Mac, and my remaining concern was the Turkish cops. Trying to discover what they were doing, I turned to the TV playing softly in the corner of the living room. It was showing a Turkish news program, but there was nothing about the killings at the rave or of a police operation heading my way. I used the remote to surf through the local channels. Soap operas, Hollywood movies dubbed in Turkish, and two more news programs, but nothing to cause alarm. Nor was there anything on the BBC, CNN, Bloomberg, or MSNBC. Chapter 36. I couldn't breathe for a moment. I was still standing on the bluff above the ruins, remembering the past, but the thought of looking at the TV in the doctor's old cottage had stolen the air from my lungs. If Dr. Sidney could get the English language news channels in a far more remote area, how come they weren't available in Bodrum? I ran for the Fiat. It was still early. There was little traffic, and the drive into Bodrum was almost as fast as when I had Mac lying in the seat beside me. I parked on the sidewalk, outside the hotel, sprinted up the steps, and saw the manager coming out of the dining room.
"Ah," he said, smiling, "was the trip of the mirrors with the largeness of glass a success?"
"I'm sorry," I replied. "I don't have time. I need to know about the TV service." He looked at me confused. Why the hell would I want to know about that? "The bellboy said you can't get the English-speaking news channels in Bodrum. Is that right?"
"That is the truth, very much," he replied. "The company of great thievery called DigiTurk, which gives us the channels of crap, has no such service."
"There must be a way. I've seen the BBC, MSNBC, and several others," I said. He thought for a moment, turned, and made a phone call. He spoke in Turkish, listened to the response, then cupped his hand over the mouthpiece as he reported to me. He said that his wife thought that some people bought digital boxes and accessed a European satellite which broadcast the news channels I was asking about. "What's the name of the service? The satellite, does she know?" I asked. The manager put the question to her, then turned to me and gave the answer.
"Sky," he said.
Sky was a British satellite broadcaster, and I knew from living in London it was a pay service. That meant there were subscribers, and if people were buying decoder boxes, somebody in the organization would have a list of them. I went up to my room fast and called the company in England. I got passed through 8 or 9 different phone extensions before I ended up with a helpful guy from the North Country whose accent was so thick you could have served a Yorkshire pudding with it. He was in charge of European subscriptions, and he told me that all the channels I was interested in were carried on Sky's premium Astra satellite.
"It's got a big footprint, that one. It was designed to cover Western Europe and reach as far as Greece. Then, quite a few years ago, the satellite software was upgraded. The signal got stronger, and suddenly you could pick it up in Turkey with a 3-foot dish. Of course, you still need the decoder box and an access card, but it means a lot more people have taken it up."
How many subscribers, Mr. Howell?
In Turkey. We've got expats, of course. They take their boxes and cards with them when they move. Then there's the English-themed pubs and clubs. The tourists want their football. Finally, we have the locals who like the programming. All up, there's probably about 10,000.
Can you break it down by area?
Of course.
How many people in the vicinity of Bodrum, say a province called Mugla? I asked, desperately trying not to let my hopes get too far ahead of me.
Give me a second,
he said, and I could hear him tapping at a computer.
It's a murder investigation, you said?
He was making conversation while he worked to get the data. Yeah, young American guy. He loved sports and TV, I lied. I'm just trying to tie a few things up.
I got it, he said. About 1,100 subscribers.
My spirits soared. It meant people in Bodrum could receive the television stations I needed. I looked out of the window and imagined the woman I was looking for sitting cross-legged in one of the white cubist houses, watching a TV with a skybox on top, grabbing sound bites from a host of different news programs and working for hours to edit and code them. 1,100 boxes. It had narrowed the search for her dramatically, and it wasn't done yet. If you discount the expatriates and the bars, how many subscribers do you think there are? I asked.
Households? Most likely 600 or 700, he replied.
I was close. 600 or 700 households was a lot of work, a lot of shoe leather to track down each one of them, but it meant the potential suspects were now ring-fenced. Somewhere among that group was the woman I was looking for.
Is that a good number?
Hal asked. Very good, I told him, unable to keep the smile out of my voice. Can you give me a list of the subscribers?
Sure, but I'd have to get authorization. No offense, but we'd need to know for certain it's the FBI who's asking.
I can get you an official letter in a couple of hours. After that, how long would it take?
It's just a download and printing it out. A few minutes.
It was better than I could have imagined. Very soon I would have a list of 600 addresses, and the woman's would be one of them. We were on our way. Thanks, I said. I can't tell you how helpful this is.
No problem. Of course, you're lucky it's only the authorized ones you want.
It stopped me in mid-celebration. What do you mean?
Well, a lot of people tuning in these days.
I started to feel sick.
Use pirated boxes,
he continued.
Chinese, mostly. If it's not Rolex watches and Louis Vuitton handbags, they're counterfeiting boxes and our access cards. They sell them through small electronic shops and internet cafes, places like that. It's a big business. Once you've bought the box and card, the service is free. You there?
And somewhere like Mugla, I said quietly. How many pirated boxes do you think there would be?
A place that size? 10,000, maybe more. There's no way of tracking who has them. It's totally underground. Next year, we think we'll have the technology to trace.
I wasn't listening. Next year, we could all be dead. 10,000 boxes and no subscriber list made it an impossible task. I thanked him for his help and hung up. I stood motionless, the silence crowding in and the black dog of despair biting at my heels. To have had my hopes raised and then so comprehensively dashed was a hard break. For the first time since I had been press-ganged into the war, just for a few moments I thought I had a real way into the problem. Now that it had turned to dust, I was in the mood to be brutal with myself. What did I really have? I asked. I had compiled a list of phone boxes. By a stroke of good fortune and the work of a team of Italian experts, I had stayed in the game. And apart from that? Anyone who didn't need a white cane could see that I had very little. I was angry, too. I was angry at the fucking Chinese for not controlling the wholesale piracy of other people's ideas and products. I was angry at Bradley and Whisperer and all the rest who weren't there to help me. And I was angry at Arabs who thought that the bigger the body count, the greater the victory. But mostly I was angry at the woman and the man in the Hindu Kush for staying ahead of me. I walked to the window and tried to find a pocket of calm. The exercise with Sky hadn't been a complete bust. It had taught me that the woman almost certainly lived in the area, and that was real progress. I looked across the rooftops. She was out there somewhere. All I had to do was find her. I tried to see in my mind which of the phone boxes she had been standing in, waiting for the phone to ring, but I had no data, and all I could draw was a blank. Yet I could hear the traffic going past, and I listened to the Muzak, the radio station, or whatever it damn well was, playing faintly in the background. Come to that, I thought. Where was the update on the music? What were Whisper and those guys doing back home? Wasn't the NSA supposed to be trying to isolate, enhance, and identify it? I was in just the mood to vent my frustration, so even though it was late in New York, I didn't care. I picked up the phone. Chapter 37. Bradley answered and told me he wasn't in bed, but from the sound of his voice, he was clearly exhausted. Well, so was I. He started to ask about Dodge's death, just to maintain the cover, but I cut him short. "Remember the music we spoke about?" I said. Of course he didn't. He had no idea what I was talking about. There was the sound of traffic. It was playing in the background.
"Oh, yeah, I remember,"
he said, getting with the program. "What happened?" I asked. "Somebody was supposed to be drilling down, trying to identify it."
"I don't know. I haven't heard."
"Get onto it, will you? Make some calls."
"Sure,"
Bradley replied, offended by my tone, immediately getting as irritable as I was.
"When do you need it by?"
"Now," I replied. "A few hours ago would have been better." Hungry as hell, I was on my third stale candy bar from the minibar and sitting in the chair, staring out at the town and thinking about the woman, when the phone rang. It was Bradley, and he said that the music was pretty much a bust.
"They filtered out the noise of the New York traffic,"
he said. The reference to New York was meaningless packaging.
"And they've enhanced the music. It's Turkish, of course. It seems it's being played on a kaval."
"A what?" I asked.
"A kaval. A wind instrument, like a flute, apparently. 7 holes on top and 1 underneath. They're the melody keys. It's a folk thing. The story is that shepherds would use it to lead their flock."
"Great. We're looking for a shepherd driving a sheep through rush hour traffic," I said.
"Not exactly," replied Bradley. "It's pretty common. They say it's very popular with folk music groups."
"A kaval, huh? What was it playing on? A CD, live, on the radio?"
"After they took out the background noise and enhanced it, they lost what they call the signatures. They can't tell."
Christ. They don't make it easy, do they? I looked across the rooftops and asked myself again, where had she been standing? Some place where you could hear traffic and music being played on a Turkish folk instrument called a kaval. Where?
"Here's another problem,"
Bradley continued.
"They can't identify the tune either. The sample's not very big, but nobody seems to have heard it."
"That's strange," I said. "You'd think if it was a folk tune and with all their experts."
"Yeah, I guess."
We were silent for a moment, and when it became clear there was nothing more to discuss, I broached another subject. "I'm sorry, Ben," I said.
"For what?"
"Being a dick."
"But you've always been a dick,"
he said, deadpan as always.
"Anyway, I told our friends you were feeling the stress and starting to crack up."
"Oh, good. That should further my career," I replied.
"Glad to help,"
he said. He didn't laugh. It was Ben Bradley, after all, but I could tell from his voice that I'd put things right with him. And I was thankful for that. "One more thing," I said.
"Sure."
"Ask him to work out a way to send the recording, will you? Just the music, not the traffic." I didn't know why, but I wanted to hear it. Chapter 38. 20 minutes later, after I had finished showering, I walked out of the bathroom and found a new email on my laptop. It was from Apple, telling me that $27 had been charged to my credit card for music downloads. I hadn't bought any music, and my fear was that some jerk at the CIA had thought it might be useful to add to Brody Wilson's already expansive collection of fucked-up music. I went to iTunes, saw a group of new tracks had arrived, and realized that most of them were just packing. There was only one that mattered, and I knew it was from Whisperer. On the night before I flew to Turkey, when we were working in his study, I saw on the wall an autographed copy of the Rolling Stones' Exile on Main Street, which, despite our fatigue, had led to a spirited discussion about whether it really was their greatest album. Who would have guessed that the country's director of national intelligence was a closet Stones expert? In scanning the new tracks, I saw that Bradley hadn't been joking when he said he had told our friend I was cracking up. Whisper had sent me the Stones' 19th Nervous Breakdown. I put my cursor on it, hit play, and listened for 30 seconds before it morphed. Planted in the middle, stripped of traffic noise and the woman's strange message, was the Caval music. Twice I played it through. It lasted for a little more than 2 minutes, then downloaded it onto my MP3 player. I thought it might give me inspiration as I headed out again to locate phone box after phone box. It didn't. It gave me a headache. By the time I had photographed the fourth one and decided to ask groups of neighborhood women if they recalled seeing a woman waiting for a phone call and drawn nothing except confused looks or a wary shake of the head, I knew it was going to be a very long day. What was that Turkish expression? Digging a well with a needle? Still, if you wanted to drink, sometimes that's what you had to do. I was walking down a narrow street, listening to the Caval and wondering again why none of the experts could identify it, when I stopped. Something had just occurred to me. I was following the map on my phone, looking for the next phone box, and it meant I had to make a right. Instead, I wheeled left and headed towards the center of town. Up ahead, I saw the purple fronds of the jacaranda tree I was looking for, and moments later, I caught sight of the guy from the record store opening up the shutters that covered the glass windows. When he saw me, he smiled.
"I thought you'd probably come back," he said, and indicated one of the classic guitars in the window. "You look like a Stratocaster kind of guy to me."
"I'd love to buy a Strat, but not today. I need some help."
"Sure," he replied.
I helped him raise the rest of the shutters, and then he led me through the front door and into the dark cavern of the music store. It was even better than I had thought. At the back, there was a cabinet full of restored turntables for those who still believed in needles and valves. A better range of modern guitars than most stores in New York, and enough vinyl pressings from the 70s to have made Whisper weep. I indicated his collection of Turkish folk instruments and told him I had a piece of music played on a Caval that I was hoping he could identify. "A lot of other people have tried," I said, "but nobody seems to be able to nail it."
"I wish my father was alive," he said. "He was an expert on the traditional stuff, but I'll give it a shot."
I queued up the MP3 player and watched as he listened. He played it 4, maybe 5 times. Then he put the player into a docking station and played it through the store's sound system. 3 tourists who had wandered in listened.
"Not exactly foot-tapping," one of them, a New Zealander, said.
He was right. The music was haunting, more like a cry on the wind. The owner played it again, his dreamy eyes focused. Then he shook his head, and I wasn't surprised. It had always been a long shot. I started to thank him, but he interrupted.
"It's not a Caval," he said.
"What?"
"That's why you're having difficulty identifying the tune. It wasn't written for a Caval. Almost anybody would have made the mistake, but I'm pretty sure it's a far older instrument. Listen."
He played it again.
"The Caval has 7 melody stops on top, and 1 underneath. This is hard. You've really got to listen, but the instrument that's playing here has only got 6 stops on top and 1 below. There's no 7th stop."
I listened one more time, but honestly I couldn't tell. I had no idea how many stops it had. "You're sure?" I asked.
"Yeah,"
he replied. "What is it, then?"
"I can't tell you anything about the tune," he said, "but I think we're listening to a Chagirtma. It's virtually forgotten. I only know about it because my father loved the old stuff. I heard the instrument once when I was a kid."
"Why are they forgotten, though? They died out?"
"Not exactly. The birds did. For a Caval, you need the wood of a plum tree, but a Chagirtma is made from the wing bone of a mountain eagle. The birds have been endangered for years, so the instrument faded away, and so did the music written for it. That's why you can't find the tune."
He removed the MP3 player from the docking station and handed it to me.
Do you know the Hotel Ducasse? He asked. You might get some help there.
Chapter 39. The Hotel Ducasse was one of the places I mentioned earlier. So fashionable, people were drilling holes in the wall to get inside. It was on the waterfront, with a private beach, cabanas you could rent for the summer for a small fortune, and a dozen flat-bottomed boats that ferried waiters, food, and drinks out to moored cruisers. That was the low end of the establishment. The exclusive section, up on the roof, was called the Sky Bar. I had come straight from the music store, and I passed through the hotel's Art Deco front doors, crossed several acres of Cuban mahogany flooring, and skirted extravagant settings of Philippe Starck furniture before I found the Sky Bar's dedicated elevator. As I approached, I saw the guy operating it, dressed in designer black pajamas, note my cheap FBI-style clothes, and ready himself to say it was reservation only. But I have a pretty good death stare when I need it, so I said it to DEFCON 1 and saw him decide that keeping me out wasn't worth dying for. He zoomed me to the top and I stepped into a zoo. The Skybar's centerpiece was a pure white, vanishing-edge pool with a glass bottom and a huge view across the bay to the Crusader Castle and, fittingly enough, the French House. Facing the pool were a handful of ultra-luxurious cabanas which seemed to be occupied by several of Eastern Europe's leading kleptocrats and their families. Slightly elevated, they commanded the best view of the pool and its huge expanse of flesh and silicon. Scantily clad women of all ages with bee-stung lips and bolt-on boobs, and young, hard-bodied guys in swimsuits so brief they were generally called banana hammocks. At the opposite end to the cabanas was the bar and a small stage for a 5-piece band. One of the guitarists was my objective, but getting there wasn't without its obstacles. The first of them was approaching me with a sympathetic smile and his hands spread wide in silent apology. It was the maitre d', and unlike his clientele, he was class all the way. French was my guess. Berluti handmade shoes, lightweight Brioni suit, gold-rimmed eyeglasses.
"I'm sorry, sir," he said. "Today we are fully booked."
I looked at the 2 dozen empty tables. It was early, and even more vacant stools at the bar. I smiled back just as pleasantly. "Yes, I can see that." He already had his arm around my shoulder, guiding me back towards the elevator where the ninja was waiting to whisk me back down to the street where I belonged. I reached into my jacket pocket, and the maitre d' assumed I was going for my wallet and a handful of bills to bribe him.
"Please, sir, don't embarrass us both," he said, with genuine pain.
"I wasn't going to," I replied, pulling out my gold shield. He looked at it for a moment, and put aside the shepherding shit while he considered what to do.
"Are you arresting someone, Mr. Wilson?"
he asked. "Probably." He leaned closer. You could tell he was a terrible gossip, and dropped his voice.
"Can you tell me you?"
I leaned in equally close, and dropped my voice to match his.
"Sorry, not allowed." "No, of course not, but you could probably say what the charge would be."
"Sure," I said, and indicated the pool area. "Bad taste." He burst out laughing and shook my hand.
"Fuck, the place will be empty. You'll need a bus."
He dismissed the ninja with a glance, raised his hand in a gesture to the distant barman, and guided me back towards the acres of flesh.
"Be my guest, Mr. Wilson. Anton at the bar will take care of your drinks."
I thanked him, walked beside the pool, and settled myself on a stool at the bar. I asked Anton for a coffee and turned my attention to the band. It was the bass player I was interested in. His name was Ahmet Pamuk, and he was in his 50s, neatly dressed, a guy who had obviously decided years ago just to play the groove and not look at the crowd. At the Sky Bar, that was probably wise. He was good. He knew his shit. The sort of man who had already given music the best years of his life and would probably be playing just one more gig until they laid him in the ground. But the owner of the music store had warned me that he was one of the most unpleasant people you could meet, and watching him on stage, seeing him at his lifetime's work, I had some understanding why. For a real musician, a man who had been full of hopes and dreams, playing endless versions of Mamma Mia and Yellow Submarine would be enough to embitter anyone. As Anton brought my coffee, Pamuk was in the middle of a set, the hits from Titanic, and I waited for him to finish. The owner had told me the guy had been collecting traditional and folk music for years. His father, a musician himself, had started it, worried that if it weren't collected and written down, it would be lost forever, and in later years his son had picked up the baton. Apparently, Pamuk got by however he could, playing at the Sky Bar, pumping gas, all the time finding lost music, playing some of the instruments himself, noting it down like a lost language, and sending it to the Turkish National Archives. According to the guy at the music store, if any local could identify the Çağırtma tune, it would be him. The set finished, the band left the stage to no applause, and I stood up. I gave Pamuk my name and told him that I had a piece of music I was hoping he could help me with. My idea had been to ask him to listen to the MP3 player, but I never got the chance. The store owner hadn't been mistaken about Pamuk's personality.
"It's the brunch crowd, and I've been on stage for an hour already. You heard the deafening applause, right?" he said. "I'm gonna eat, I'm gonna have a coffee, and then I'm gonna rest."
He turned to walk away. "Mr. Pamuk," I replied, "I'm not a musicologist or some foreign academic." I flashed him the shield. He wasn't sure how to react, but decided it might be wiser to at least pay lip service to cooperation.
"Okay, I'll give you a phone number. Call me tomorrow, we'll set the time," he said.
"Tomorrow's not good enough, it'll have to be today," I countered. He glared at me, but he had never met the DEFCON 1 before, and buckled.
"From 4 o'clock, I work at 176,
and he rattled off the name of a street that I had no hope of pronouncing, let alone finding, as I was sure he knew. Asshole. "Write it down, please," I told him, and motioned to Anton that I needed a pen. Grudgingly, Pamuk complied, and as I walked away, I slipped the address into my pocket. I almost didn't bother. In light of his personality, I was certain the meeting was going to be a waste of time. Chapter 40. Apart from having to stab him through the fleshy part of his hand, my follow-up conversation with Ahmet Pamuk actually turned out to be quite pleasant. After I left the Sky Bar, I walked along the harbor, found a bench in the shade, slid the battery back into my phone, and called Kumali at the station house. I hadn't spoken to her since Florence, and I wanted to check any progress on the newly launched investigation into Dodge's murder. As it turned out, very little had happened. Hayrunisa picked up the call and told me Kumali had left just after 11 a.m. and wouldn't be back for the rest of the day. "Where's she gone?" I asked.
"Just a few private things she had to attend to," she replied.
I was about to press her when I realized it was Thursday, and that Kumali's son had invited me to see the grand parade and the clowns. She had taken him to the state circus. I said I would call back in the morning, and then spent another hour checking with people working near phone boxes, again to no avail, and realized that, with lunchtime approaching and most offices and stores closing, it was about to become a near-to-hopeless task. With little choice but to take a break, I decided to turn my attention to the French house. My confidence had been badly shaken by the mistake that Whisper and I had made. We had jeopardized our entire mission by assuming that the death of Dodge would be a case worth investigating. Such errors rarely went unpunished in the secret world, and on the plane back from Florence, I had resolved never to let it happen again. Come what may, I was going to stay one step ahead of the cops. Knowledge is power, as they say. The core question was simple. How did the killer manage to enter and leave the estate without being seen? Included in the files about Dodge's death that Kumali had given me was a reference to the company responsible for letting the mansion, and I figured that was the best place to start. Prestige Realty was its name, and I had seen its flashy storefront a number of times during my walking tours. I glanced at my watch and saw that, if I hurried, I had a chance of getting there before it too closed for lunch. I got within hailing distance just as a man was locking the front door. When he heard me calling to him in English, he turned and switched on the smile that realtors reserve for someone they think might have just got off the boat. As soon as he saw me, he switched it off. He was in his early 40s, with a full pompadour, an open-necked shirt, and a rope of gold chains around his neck big enough to anchor a cruise liner. I liked him immediately. In a strange way, there was no guile to him. If you got ripped off by a man who looked like that, I figured you only had yourself to blame. I introduced myself, told him I was with the FBI and that I wanted to discuss the French House. He shrugged and said that one of the local cops had visited him about a week ago and taken a photocopy of the lease. He was just the realtor and there was really nothing more he could add. He was obviously in a hurry to leave and I apologized for taking his time. As a rule, I've always found it helps to be polite, and told him the local cop had called by when it had been an investigation into an accidental death.
"What is it now, then?"
he asked, surprised. Obviously, the word hadn't leaked out about the overnight developments in the case, although I guessed that what I was about to tell him would mean most of Bodrum would know by nightfall. I looked at the glass front door and saw his name in gold letters. "It's a murder investigation, Mr. Kea. The young American was pushed off the cliff." It shocked him. Upset him, too.
"He was a nice man," he said. "Not like most of the assholes who rent mansions here. He talked, showed an interest. He said he was going to take me out in his boat."
Shit.
Murdered?
You can understand why I need to talk to you.
I was just going to lunch.
Good. I'll join you. He laughed.
"You know that wasn't what I meant."
"Yeah," I smiled. "But where are we eating?" Chapter 41. It was a high-end barbecue joint on the beach. A polished deck overhanging the sand, sails of white canvas filtering the sun, designer furniture, and, not surprisingly, given my host, a frontline view of groups of tourist chicks sunbathing topless. As soon as we sat down, I asked him if he knew about the house's Nazi past, and he looked at me as if I had forgotten to take my medication.
"You're kidding, right?" he said.
He looked at my face and saw that I wasn't. "Who owns it?" was my next question.
"I don't know, not exactly,"
he replied, sort of shaken.
"I got a letter, this would be about 7 years ago, from a lawyer in Liechtenstein, saying he represented a charitable trust which owned the property. He said the trustees had decided they wanted it to produce an income."
"Did you ask him who was behind the trust, who the real owner was?" I inquired.
"Sure. I even got my own lawyer to try to find out, but it led through a series of nominee companies into a dead end."
I didn't say anything, but I knew most Liechtenstein trusts were designed to be impenetrable. That was the reason why the tiny principality, 60 square miles sandwiched between Switzerland and Austria, was the first port of call for Europeans, primarily Germans, wanting to hide assets from their tax authorities. "So, the lawyer acting for the trustees says he wanted you to rent it out. This was after the renovations?"
"That's right. And it was good money for not much work. I collected the rent, deducted the maintenance expenses and my commission, and forwarded the balance to a bank in Liechtenstein. That was it."
"Who had a key to the estate?" I asked. "Apart from you?"
"Nobody has a key. Just codes. There are 4 gates. They're all on electronic keypads linked to a computer. You can't tamper with them."
"Okay, so how does it work? A new tenant arrives for their stay, then what?"
"I meet their estate manager at the house. All these people have estate managers and personal assistants," he said. "I enter my 6-digit code into the keypad and hit hash. The screen asks me if I want to change the code, and I say yes. I then have to enter my code again, wait 20 seconds, and it tells me to put in the new code. I take a walk, and the estate manager or the tenant enters their own 6 numbers. That way I have no idea what it is. We do the same thing at the other 3 gates."
"Then they decide who to give the code to?" I asked.
"Exactly. They bring their staff with them, all security checked, so it's not as if they give it out to strangers."
"What about gardeners, the pool guy, people like that?"
"It's up to the tenant, but I've never heard of anyone giving the code to any locals. They make them ring the intercom on the tradesman's entrance, The security chief checks them out and opens the gates personally.
And at the end of the lease, it's the reverse, right? They enter their code and you replace it with yours?
You got it.
I paused, thinking. And in winter, when there are no tenants...
There's no need for that level of security, he replied.
So, you give the gardeners and the pool guy your code?
Not exactly. There's a caretaker who stays on the property for part of the year. He lets them in and does some maintenance. He uses two rooms in the attic over the boathouse, but he has to move out when summer starts. Rich people don't like strangers on the property.
But he lives there 8 months of the year.
Pretty much, he replied.
He'd know the house better than anyone.
I guess.
What's his name?
Gianfranco Luca.
Where can I find him?
He's got a summer job here on the beach. Runs a little team that gives massages to tourists.
The waiter was hovering nearby, and I signaled to him to bring the bill. Kea offered to give me a ride back into the old town, but I said it was a beautiful day and I preferred to walk. He got to his feet, we shook hands, and he gave me a business card, made to look like a gold ingot, and told me to call him if I needed any more information. It wasn't until he had left, and I was waiting for my change, that I glanced down at the card and solved another one of life's mysteries. In the bottom right-hand corner was his office phone number. The first 7 digits were 902-5234. The numbers that someone had written down at the East Side Inn and flushed on the toilet. I figured that whoever was living there had been making inquiries about renting an expensive mansion in the area. Something like the French House. Chapter 42. I didn't head back into town. Instead, I made my way through the restaurant's car park, hit the beach, and found a kiosk that rented out deck chairs and umbrellas. I set up camp on the sand, put my shoes and jacket on the chair, rolled up my chinos, and let the water surge across my feet as I walked along the beach. At the far end, close to the base of a small bluff and half hidden among a scattering of boulders, I found Gianfranco's operation. Quite by accident, and moving through the shadow cast by the boulders, I approached it from behind. Privacy was supposed to be provided by canvas screens with the name of his business on them, but they had been poorly arranged, and I had a chance to observe him through a gap. He was in his mid-twenties, olive-skinned, with 2 days' stubble and a shock of wavy hair. Yeah, he was good-looking, but probably not quite as handsome as he thought. His eyes were set too deep, and he was a little too muscle-bound. Nevertheless, he must have seemed attractive to middle-aged German women who were on vacation and looking for fun and maybe something a little more physical in the hot Turkish sun. One of them was lying face down on the massage table, the top of her two-piece swimming costume unhooked and a towel covering her butt. Gianfranco, in a white banana hammock and nothing else, was working one of his 20 oils, prepared from ancient recipes, according to the bullshit on his privacy screens, into the woman's back, lightly running his fingers over her side boobs. She made no objection, and having dipped his toe in the water, he leaned further over, slipping his massaging hands down under the towel covering her ass and bringing the white hammock within an inch of her face. It was impossible to tell if his hands were inside her swimming costume or not, but it didn't matter. They would be soon. Remember the days when divorced middle-aged women went on vacation and the most adventurous thing they did was drink too much and buy some tacky souvenirs? No wonder the tourist shops in the old town were going broke. As he kneaded her butt under the towel, she complimented him on how strong his hands were. I guessed English was the only language they had in common.
Yeah, I built them up as a kid, he said. I worked in the car wash. I was an expert on the full wax and the polish.
I bet you were, she laughed. Did you do interiors as well?
Oh, yeah, he replied. They were my specialty.
He leaned closer.
They still are. I just charge a little extra. And how about the complete detailing? How much is that?
He was close enough to whisper in her ear, and she must have thought it was okay.
You take credit cards? She asked. Of course, he replied, laughing,
his hands clearly inside her swimming costume by then.
This is a full-service operation.
And I'm glad to hear it,
she said, her hand touching his muscular thigh and starting to move up towards the hammock. It was a bit like watching an imminent train wreck. Hard to drag your eyes away, but I feared she was about to let the banana loose, so I stepped between the screens. Gianfranco, is it? I asked happily, making out that I hadn't noticed anything unusual. The German woman instantly drew her hand away and made sure the towel was covering her butt. Gianfranco, on the other hand, was furious, abusing me for intruding and pointing at the privacy screens and telling me I would be lucky if he didn't break my ass. I was content to let it blow through, but it seemed the more he thought about that unused credit card, the more he whipped himself into a frenzy, and he went to push me hard. I caught his forearm in midair, so fast I don't think he realized what was happening, and pressed my thumb and index finger right into the bone. Krav Maga had taught me that there is a nerve there which, when put under stress, partially paralyzes the hand. Giancarlo felt his fingers go limp. It probably wasn't the only thing, and realized that his hand wasn't responding. He looked at me, and I smiled. I'm with the FBI, I said cheerily. The German woman had already got off the table, pulled her top up, and was grabbing her few possessions off a chair.
What do you want? Gianfranco demanded.
I picked up his shorts from a table, tossed them to him, and waited while he pulled them on one-handed. I'm investigating a murder at the French house, I said.
What's that got to do with me? I only work there in the winter.
I noted the answer, noted it carefully, but I glided into the next question without any apparent pause. Just keep it normal, I told myself. No pressure. So I understand. A bit of maintenance. Let the pool guy in, help the gardeners. Is that right?
Yeah.
He was flexing his fingers, feeling the movement returning. How much do you get paid?
Nothing. Free board, that's all. I have to make enough on the beach in summer to keep me all year.
He glanced to where the German Hausfrau had disappeared.
Thanks a lot, by the way. She was good for at least 100.
I ignored it. You live above the boat shed, yeah? How do you get up to the house?
There's a set of steps behind. They go up the cliff.
Protected by a security gate and an electronic keypad. You use Mr. K's code?
That's right, when he remembers to give it to me.
And if you don't use the steps, how do you get up there?
I don't understand.
Sure you do. There's another way onto the estate, isn't there?
You mean climbing up the cliff with ropes and pitons?
Don't be cute. How does someone bypass the gates and cameras and get up there?
I don't know what you're talking about, he said.
I didn't respond. I just kept looking at him. And though he became increasingly uncomfortable, he didn't add anything to it. I shrugged and let it go. I knew he was lying. He was so full of shit that if I gave him an enema, I could have fitted him in a shoebox. The reason I was certain was simple. When we had first started talking, I had said I was investigating a murder. Everyone in Bodrum thought Dodge's death was an accident. Even Kea, the realtor, had found it hard to believe, and the thing that I had noted was that Gianfranco hadn't shown any surprise. None at all. I couldn't tell what part he had played in the events at the house. My intuition was that it was probably very little, but he knew there was another way up, and he knew what it was. "Thank you for your help, Mr. Luca," I said. I'm sure we'll be talking again. He didn't appear overjoyed at that prospect, and maybe I would have changed my mind and stayed to pursue things with him, but it was 4:40. Time to go. Chapter 43. I returned to my deck chair, put my shoes on, and walked fast back into town. Using the map in my head, I made my way down half a dozen narrow steps, skirted the side of a plaza, and up ahead, saw heavy traffic passing down the road I was looking for. I reached the intersection, looked in both directions to locate number 176, and realized I had been there before. Suddenly, the world shifted on its axis. In that one moment, that one crystalline dot of time, the balance of the hopeless investigation swung in my favor, and I knew I had found the phone box I was looking for. I was standing on the opposite side of the thoroughfare, 10 yards from a BP gas station. I recognized it because it was one of the boxes which I had photographed on my first day. All around me was the sound of the traffic we had heard in the background of the echelon recording. Number 176 was the gas station, and, unlike the first time I had seen it, a man was sitting in a chair outside, ready to pump gas. It was Ahmet Pamuk, and on a table in front of him were a clutch of leather and woodworking tools he was using to repair a traditional Turkish string instrument. Repairing an instrument today, I thought, playing one on a different occasion. A çığırtma, for instance. I didn't move, and as I had done so many times before in my professional life, I excluded the confusion of the world and turned my mind inwards. I saw a woman approach. She either came on foot and walked close to the fuel pumps or arrived by car and left it on one side of the gas station. It was the only place to park in the vicinity. She stepped up to the phone box, waited for the phone to ring, and then held up her cell phone with its recorded message. There were no shops or houses nearby where somebody could have observed her. Probably the reason it had been chosen, but her cell phone had been just far enough from the mouthpiece of the phone for Echelon to pick up the noise of the traffic and the faint sound of Ahmet Pamuk. The musician would have been at his table, playing the strange wind instrument, probably writing down the notes of the folk song and preparing to send it to the archives. I said nothing, did nothing, felt nothing. I ran it through my mind once more to ensure that my longing for information hadn't colored my logic. Satisfied at last, determined not to surrender to any emotion, I turned and looked at every square inch of the gas station's office and roof. I was searching for pointers, and only when I found them did I unchain my feelings and let my heart soar. Against all the odds, working with nothing more than a couple of sounds captured by accident, I had found the phone box, and thanks to what I had just seen, I knew I had a chance of identifying the woman. Chapter 44. I crossed one half of the road, climbed over a rusty railing used as a divider, dodged a swarm of oncoming vehicles, and headed towards Pamuk. He saw me approach and didn't bother to hide his disgust. At least it allowed me to dispense with the pleasantries. "You own or borrowed from someone a çığırtma?" I asked.
"A what?" he replied.
I was pretty sure my pronunciation wasn't that bad and he was just being a prick.
"A çığırtma," I repeated.
He looked blank and shrugged.
"I don't know what you're talking about, American. Maybe it's the accent."
I managed to keep my temper and picked up a stitching awl, a long, pointed spike he had been using to pierce leather for his repair work. I scratched the surface of his table with it.
"Hey, what you doing?"
he objected, but I ignored it. "There it is," I said, when I had finished scratching out the name of the instrument. "Recognize it now?"
"Oh yeah,"
he said, barely glancing at it.
"The çığırtma."
Strange, it sounded almost identical to my pronunciation. "You were playing one here at the table about a week ago. Maybe a folk song for the archives?" I was only asking him to make absolutely certain I had found the right phone box. Plenty of investigations had foundered on agents desperate for information leaping to the wrong conclusion.
"I don't know. I can't recall,"
he said, with a surliness that was hard to believe. I have to admit that I was amped. At last I was close to finding a tangible lead in the labyrinth, and maybe that was why I snapped. I was still holding the stitching awl, a nasty little bastard of a thing, and Pamuk's left hand was resting on the table. It was so fast I doubt he even saw it. I drove the end of the needle straight through the thin web of skin between his thumb and index finger, pinning his hand to the table. He screamed in pain, but he should have thanked me for being a good shot. Half an inch either way, and he would never have played bass again. Immediately, I grabbed his forearm to stop him moving. In such a situation, most people's impulse is to pull their hand away, and in doing so, he would have ripped the web of flesh apart and increased the damage dramatically. Immobilizing him meant that all he had was a puncture wound, which, painful as it was, would heal quickly. It was funny, though, how a steel awl through the hand concentrated his mind. He looked at me, listening to every word I said, biting his lip with the pain. "You're a good bass player," I told him. "Maybe one of the best I've heard, and I know what I'm talking about. but it's not the world's fault it didn't work out for you. You don't like playing covers of other people's music? Then leave. Write stuff. Put on concerts of folk music for tourists. Do something. But drop the attitude. That's the advice. Here's the warning. Lie to me now, and I promise you won't be able to do any of those things, not even Mamma Mia for the 10,000th time. You'll be lucky if you can strum a ukulele with your fucking teeth. Okay? He nodded, scared, probably thinking I was some sort of U.S. government-sanctioned psycho. I thought of telling him that was the post office, not the FBI, but decided to let it ride. I ordered him to hold perfectly still, and I managed to extract the awl without causing any further damage. He gasped with the pain, but that was nothing compared with the yell he let out when I doused the wound with a liberal splash from the open bottle of Rocky standing on the table. Alcohol, I explained, is a great antiseptic. I grabbed a piece of white linen he had been intending to use to polish the folk instrument when he was finished and bound his hand. I did it expertly, just tight enough to ease the pain and restrict the bleeding.
"You are a doctor?"
he asked. "No," I said. "I just picked up a bit of knowledge along the way. Dressing gunshot wounds, mostly." He stared at me and decided I wasn't joking, which was the attitude I needed. "Were you playing the chigurtma, yes or no?" I asked again as soon as I had tied off the bandage.
"Yes,"
he replied, thankful to have his hand back and flexing the fingers to make sure they still worked. "How was my pronunciation this time? Okay?"
"Not bad," he said. "It seems to have improved greatly, thanks to the needle."
I couldn't help it. I laughed. I poured him a shot of the Rocky and took the edge off my voice. "I want you to listen to a piece of music," I said, pulling out the MP3 player. "Is that you?" He listened for a moment.
"Yeah. Yeah, it is,"
he replied, his voice full of surprise. I knew then, without any doubt, that logic had not fallen victim to emotion.
"How did you record it?"
Pamuk asked, indicating the MP3 player. "Somebody came in to get gas," I lied. "A person in the car was on the phone and left a message on an answering machine in New York. The music was playing in the background. It's a murder investigation. I can't say any more than that." The last thing I wanted was to reveal the importance of the phone box, even allude to its existence, and I was pleased to see he was totally down with my explanation.
"New York," he said, smiling. "Wow, an international recording artist at last."
I smiled and indicated what I'd seen on the gas station's office and roof. "You've got video cameras?" I said.
"Yeah, in case anyone drives off without paying. Armed robberies, too, but there hasn't been one in years."
"Listen, Mr. Pamuk, this is important. What system is used to record the footage? Tape or disc?"
"It's old. Tape," he replied. "VHS.
"Where is it? The system and the tapes?"
"They're both here, in the office."
"Okay," I said. "How are the tapes catalogued, filed?" He laughed.
"What filing? There's a box and the tapes are thrown in."
"Then reused, recorded over?"
"That's right," he said.
It was exactly what I had feared. That one of the cameras had captured the woman approaching the phone box, either on foot or by car, but that the tape had been reused and the footage wiped. "Okay," I said. "Tell me how it works. Who changes the tapes?"
"We all do, whoever's working," he explained. "The first thing you do when you start your shift is to make sure the right amount of money is in the cash register, and then you check the recording equipment. If the tape is close to running out," he continued, "you eject it, throw it in the box, select another one, rewind it, and hit record."
"So some tapes might not have been used for weeks or months, that right?" I asked.
"Sure, depends on which one somebody grabs. For all I know, ones at the bottom of the box might not have been used for a year."
I took a moment to think. It was going to be a roll of the dice, that was for sure. "What happens if somebody drives off without paying?" I queried.
"We go to the system, wind it back, take down the license tag, and call the cops."
"Do you give them the tape? For a prosecution? Anything like that?" He looked at me and laughed in disbelief.
This is Turkey, Mr. Wilson. The cops trace the license tag and go talk to the guy.